Good evening. You are with the BizNews Briefing. I'm Alec Hogg, editor of BizNews. And today we're going to be talking a lot about today's developments in Tshwane, where the executive mayor, Celia Brunk, was ousted in a vote of 120-87. His 18-month-old coalition government is now, collapsed. Action SA's Herman Mashaba has left. And what does this mean for the government of national unity? Remember, the ANC and the DA are working together pretty well in that government of national unity. Now we find in the capital city, the DA mayor being removed by the ANC and others. Interesting stuff. We'll be hearing from France Grenier and Neil De Beer in a little while. First, let's kick off with some good news on the government of national unity. And today I had the opportunity of catching up with Dr. Leon Schreiber. He is the Minister of Home Affairs. And in the 88 days that he's had the job, he's been saying things like, we are the enabler of economic growth in South Africa. We're here to create jobs, jobs, and jobs. Sounds a bit strange being Home Affairs, but actually, the deeper you look into it, and certainly if you go and watch that full interview, it's a whole half hour, but worth every minute, with Dr. Schreiber, you will see exactly what he means. Let's pick up with him, though, on an area that many people are interested in, tourism.
One study suggests that 0.6% of GDP, annual GDP growth, could be triggered by just a 10% increase in tourism. And you're talking there about tens of thousands of new jobs by that one intervention alone. Of course, Alec, last year, South Africa's economy grew as a total by 0.6%. So this one intervention can double economic growth just by unlocking tourism. So I agree with you. There's huge potential for us here. And I think it's one of the key indicators that I'm going to be watching and pushing the department on to make sure, you know, the reforms we are pursuing, they must actually result in an increase in tourism. That's the measure we have to be following as Home Affairs in order to play that economic role in this space.
This trusted tour operator project of yours, just could you give it to us in a nutshell what it means and how it's going to affect those who are in the tourism industry or want to get in?
Yeah, so we already have something called a trusted employer scheme, which is working very well. And the tour operator scheme will basically extend the logic of that project. So what it will do is it will allow tour operators from China or who bring Chinese tourists to South Africa to pre-register with Home Affairs. They will be vetted and screened and security checked up front. And then they will sign a memorandum with the department where they will assume some of the risk. In other words, if they bring tourists to South Africa who end up overstaying or break the law in some manner, then they will be held responsible through being fined or being kicked out of the program or whatever the case may be. But in return for taking on some of that responsibility, we will then cut the red tape. We will enable them to submit group applications rather than individual applications. And, you know, these are the technicalities that people often don't understand or don't think about when you look at how government can enable economic growth. When we have a large tour group applying as a group of individuals, and you have to have everything from bank statements to clearance certificates, you know, the whole shebang, it's a huge administrative burden. So we're lessening the burden in return, essentially, for the companies sharing some of the risk and responsibility with us. But we are confident this has worked very well in the trusted employer scheme, where we have, I think, about 80 large corporates now who have done exactly the same thing. And that is already contributing. I mean, if you think about where the Kuberg engineers came from, well, they have to come into South Africa. They have to be facilitated through Home Affairs. And we now want to do the same thing for tourism, starting with China and India. And I'm really very excited about the potential of this program to really, in the immediate term, within a matter of months and maybe a year from now, we should have a conversation saying, look at how the number of tourists are increasing.
He's a reflection of how the maturity at the top level of the alliances in politics are actually delivering results already. We're seeing the impact on the stock markets, on interest rates, on the interest from international investors. However, there's a lot of work to be done. We'll find out more about that from Peter Major later in the program. I spoke to him in British Columbia. He got up early in the morning to give us some insights. This is on the mining story because there's not great news coming out of that sector. There is, however, the Joburg mining indaba next week, and that should be opening a few more eyes. Maybe Kweli Mantashe will use the opportunity to give us some good news on that side. There is good news coming out of the Bureau for Economic Research at the Stellenbosch University. Today, the Business Confidence Index among banks, IT companies, professionals, leisure, transport, and hospitality sectors, that's so-called other services, went up from 55 to 58 in the third quarter. It started the year with 6 out of 10 respondents to the survey being dissatisfied, pessimistic in other words. Now, 6 out of 10 are satisfied or optimistic. I wonder how they're going to feel after hearing the news that Celia Brunk has been ousted as the mayor of Tshwane, and indeed that there is now a little split line or a fracture being evident between the ANC and the DA, which could go all the way up to the government of national unity. But not so fast, says Dr. Franz Grenier. Here's his thoughts on today's big vote.
A lot of distance to cover until we get to December 2027. So it's not Chernobyl. It's not that at all. All that it is, it's a little crack that's open. But if that crack runs and opens more broadly and becomes a chasm, then should be one day this GNU collapse far into the future and be no longer, and you get the ANC, EFF, Tom Bemke government in power, then it might be fair for an analyst then to say, you know, looking back, that little vote in that city, that was the first firm indicator that we had since the election that Ramaphosa's grip on the ANC is not as firm as supporters of the GNU, including those within the ANC, would like to think. That the ANC, DA, GNU works because the two sides can't fish effectively in each other's ponds. And that will, for a long time, remain the case. And they're deep, very well-researched and understood reasons for that. And that still, I think, overwhelmingly holds true. I suppose the ideal thing that both parties would want to see in the data we put out next week is that both of them have seen their support increase chiefly in and around their core constituencies. But if that data starts to show, for example, that the one is losing ground to the other, then that's going to introduce all manner of tensions into the GNU on both sides. I mean, the dissidents don't only sit in the ANC. There's some good people around the DA who said, you know, be very cautious about the broader national GNU, not this Pretoria thing, the broader national. And then that raised valid arguments. But I think the way this thing holds together is that the leadership understands, which I think has been understood, that we work effectively as partners because it's very difficult for either side to fish in the other's pond. The DA is a 20 to 25, maybe on a great day, 30% party. The ANC is a party that can hold levels in the 40s, and the interests of our constituents are aligned. And of course, we must compete. The DA must try and get more. The ANC must try and get back to 50. I mean, it must do that. Maybe if it governs well, it will. But I think if a faction in the ANC gains an upper hand that decides to double down on the populist vote, the effect of that, if we remain a free society, will be to set in motion a chain of events that can knock ANC support way back into the 20s. And the DA and, you don't know what future parties may be around, would then have, in the longer term, a plausible route to silence a populist ANC pulling off a national majority. So I think whoever this is in the ANC that thinks that what they're doing in China is a good idea, they are doing something extremely dangerous for their own selves that may simply accelerate the steep descent that this recent election result showed us the ANC is on.
It is a reality, as we predicted, Celia Brink no longer the mayor of Tshwane. And this, if you look at it as a stick of dynamite and you put the fuse, I will tell you today, the first fuse was lit in the Joburg Metro a couple of months ago. The second one is now lit in Tshwane. And I predict, Chris, the third one, it's on its way to Ekurhuleni.
So what is the strategy here, Neil?
Well, the beating of the drum on the ground told me that still at the very last moment, there was a scenario of a thinking from the ANC that they might be able to take the GNU down to GLU, Government of Local Unity. I understand it was still on a knife's edge, but I can tell you today that no doubt in the office of Mr. Lesufi, not in the office of Letuli House, there is great cheering. There are definitely songs of victory. And this is, I think, the march of a man who is not at all adverse to doing anything but to get his way to garnish power. And he's now going to go for Gauteng. It is my opinion, Chris, this will have to be proved in the future, that no doubt Mr. Lesufi is putting his huge, huge card on the table for the national conference of the ANC in 2 years. I think you've got a faction rising.
That's Neil De Beer, the president of the UIM, talking to my colleague Chris Stain this afternoon after the release of the votes. And before him, you heard Dr. Franz Cronier. Well, in the conversation with Leon Schreiber earlier today, he said that research had shown that there were two big issues that were holding back economic growth in South Africa. The one was Eskom. The second one was skills. Now, Schreiber's doing his best to bring skills into the country by introducing a points-based system. Again, you can watch that video and all the other videos that we're taking snippets out of on BizNews TV on YouTube. But as far as electricity is concerned, we have a situation where the former shadow minister of electricity, Samantha Graham-Murray, is now the deputy minister. So in the electricity department, things seem to be working really well. Here's what she had to say when she was in conversation with Chris earlier today.
Yeah, you know, it's a really difficult scenario because, you know, we've got a whole new structure of Eskom that's coming into play, because obviously with the unbundling of Eskom, we now have the transmission side of Eskom, and then we have the generation side, and we have distribution. So it'll be three separate organizations, and we have to fund that unbundling in some way. But absolutely, we agree with you that, you know, the proposed hike is not tenable for the average person. People are already battling. We are finding that there is a huge energy poverty that's happening in this country, where people are having to literally choose between putting food on the table and paying for electricity. But obviously, our main focus is going to be on what we call the three A's in our ministry, and that's access, affordability, and availability. So we have to address all three A's if we're going to make sure that we have a stable, sustainable supply of electricity, that people do have access to it, but it has to be affordable. So we are looking at the energy pricing policy. We're reviewing that. We've got that going through a number of iterations with various stakeholders. I know that Eskom have just applied for a huge tariff amendment. We have to review the tariff structures. There's a lot that we have to do. And we're also going to look at how we repurpose some of the grants that are used for electrification, so that we can look at ways where we can take people off the grid, so that people are using off-grid solutions which are not necessarily then incurring the additional tariff costs. So there are a number of interventions that we are investigating, but right now it's very concerning because we don't know how we're going to address it. We have to look at cost of supply, we have to look at affordability, and we have to balance the two to make sure that Eskom is obviously getting what it needs in order to continue to provide electricity, but that people are not being forced to choose between power and food.
Well, she was referring, of course, to the 35% increase that Eskom has asked NERSA to give it. On the other side, we did have a upbeat presentation at the recent BizNews conference from the chairman of Eskom, Mteto Nyati, who explained that the first priority was to make sure there was enough electricity around and no more load shedding. Now that that appears to have been achieved, the next big focus, he says, is on cutting costs and taking the hard decisions that are required to achieve that. So there's a plan. It might not be something that we see immediately, but as you heard from Ms. Graham Murray, there is something in the works. And on the government of national unity, at that level anyway, there's a lot going on. Still with the whole electricity sector, a lot's going on with nuclear at the moment. And a big meeting was held in London yesterday, and we will get the feedback from our partners at the Financial Times, but also the local angle on it from Calvin Kem, who is a nuclear expert, all about nuclear and how that could be added soon to the mix of energy in South Africa. Let's start with our partners at the Financial Times.
Banks gave nuclear energy the thumbs up this week. On Monday, some of the world's biggest lenders met up in New York to pledge their support for the sector. This turned heads because nuclear is pretty divisive in a lot of boardrooms. To tell me about whether the tide could now be turning is the FT's Lee Harris. Tell me a little bit more about this meeting. Who was there and what did they say?
So a number of big banks and financial institutions showed up. They included Citi, Barclays, Goldman Sachs, and BNP Paribas. And they were joined by a bunch of high-ranking state officials. And they were there to back this pledge to increase support for nuclear energy. The banks were pretty light on the specifics of what this actually means for their lending, which I think is in itself really telling. You definitely got a sense that nuclear financing is still extremely sensitive within these institutions. But the banks say that broadly, they want to support a goal that was first set out last year at the COP climate conference to triple the world's nuclear energy capacity by 2050.
Just how big of a deal would you say this is? I mean, you mentioned that there is still a lot of caution coming from these institutions about nuclear power.
Yeah, I think it is a big deal. Cynically, you might say this is just kind of virtue signaling by the banks, but I think it's pretty important that they decided that this is something that they want to virtue signal about, because of course, nuclear remains controversial for a bunch of reasons. One is that a kind of older generation of environmental activists was really built around opposition to nuclear. Also, it's controversial just because it's hard to do. Recent nuclear projects have come in way above cost and over schedule. So in the past, senior management at banks have typically steered clear.
I'm curious about why banks are changing their tune now on nuclear.
I think the biggest reason might just be that they expect kind of an explosion of demand that's primarily fueled by big tech companies and their computing needs from AI. So on Friday, Microsoft announced a 20-year deal with Constellation Energy to restart a nuclear reactor at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. That's an 835-megawatt reactor, or enough energy to power about 800,000 homes. So a really substantial deal. I think these banks are seeing more of this demand coming down the pike.
What could support from these financial institutions look like, and how could it affect the sector more broadly?
We're still waiting on specifics, but banks could potentially support new plants by increasing direct lending and project finance to nuclear. They could also arrange bond sales or introduce companies to private equity or credit funds. I think there's a hope that if banks and financial institutions can agree collectively to finance this energy source, it could really bring down costs. And of course, unleashing a wave of new investment in the sector would go a long way towards meeting net zero clean energy goals.
is being realized that nuclear power is the future. My experience in South Africa has been that banks are too scared to get involved. What a pity. At the conference, the Deputy Prime Minister of Sweden, Her Excellency Ebba Busch, said, "You know the most beautiful word I know? Baseload." Thankfully, she articulated the important distinction between baseload reliable electricity and intermittent unreliable electricity. There's a huge difference. Nuclear is baseload. Over the last couple of years, the nuclear team in Pretoria has received considerable interest from foreign funders and potential customers for our unique South African small modular reactor development. But then they tend to say, if your development is so great, how come your own political leaders and own industrial leaders are not supporting you? We have to reply that our industrial and business leaders do not seem to have the vision and courage to make a move. We are receiving a great deal of encouragement, but so many of the captains of industry are acting like lieutenants, waiting for a real leader to step forward to offer guidance towards the future.
One of the major issues for miners in South Africa has been electricity. There are other issues as well, and we'll hear from those in a moment from our go-to mining expert, Peter Major. But just to put this into some context, what we're going to hear in just a moment is that Barlow World, which is a heavy industrial equipment mover, if you like, it's an industrial conglomerate, but primarily it deals with organizations like mines and construction companies. Its revenues for the 11 months to the end of August, it was a voluntary trading update that was posted on the Stock Exchange News Service today, showed that revenues are down 7%. And when it explained this, the company said the South African clients, in particularly the mining industry, are seeing costs go up and they're unable to maintain their purchases, or they're not in a position to buy from people like Barlow World because they don't have the cash. Here's Peter Major.
Yeah, they were getting hurt by higher costs. And I don't want to wear out this argument, but where do the higher costs come from? And government has to take the responsibility for this. Look at, let's just pretend we're starting a mine from scratch. How is our infrastructure? Not great. How is our legislation, you know, the licensing process to get those? Horrible. And even if our licensing process, Alec, worked first class, look at the kind of rules our guys have to do. And all these things add cost. That's what the government seems to have missed the most, is all their actions help a company on cost or hurt a company on cost. Well, boy, across the board, their actions have hurt all South Africans. But on mining, because they've specifically targeted mining, it's hurt their costs umpteen times more. We always hear mining inflation is almost double what the consumer inflation is. I don't know if it's quite that bad, but it is worse, and it's consecutively worse because government has intentionally passed legislation to hurt mining, and that translates into higher costs. You can't separate the two. I know government doesn't believe that, but it's true. If you're hurting somebody, their costs of survival are higher. And they've continually hurt mining. They specifically target mining. It's like every third or fourth word goes back to mining. They've just had this ingrained hate for the existing mining companies and management and shareholders, and all their actions have reflected that. So yes, when you see massive investment in places like Zambia and the DRC, which are hard to operate in, you know, electricity, transport, getting your people there, getting your equipment, those are hard places to operate in. And yet foreign companies are putting tens of billions of dollars in those hard to operate places because they think their costs will be lower than if they were putting it in South Africa.
Sure. What about the new government of national unity? Is there some light on the horizon there?
Look, without a doubt, for the average guy, there is light there. The mining companies, they see the light, but there's a big difference between somebody shining a light on you and saying, oh my gosh, look at the horrible state you're in. You're chained up. You're underfed. The rain's dripping on you. Oh, at least when the light's on you, it means someone sees your plight. But now they have to do something about it. So there is light with the GNU. There's people involved in this new government who understand business, who understand politics, who understand what the previous government was doing to everyone in South Africa, individuals and companies. So, yeah, it's great having somebody finally open the door and they say, I hear your screams here. I'm trying to do something about it, but the manacles are really thick.
Calling a spade a bloody shovel, as always, Peter Major. He's on his way back from British Columbia, where he has an operation that he's looking after. He's also looking after an operation in Idaho, and he is South African coming back home specifically for the Joburg Mining Indaba, which is being held next week. We finish today's program with on a lighter note, but before we get there, the markets have had a good session today, despite what happened in Tshwane, despite the concerns that Peter Major is expressing. The industrials and mining shares were up by more than 2% on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. A particularly good day for the Prosus Naspers combine. They were up by 7%. And the reason for that is the jump in Chinese shares. And remember that Naspers and Prosus own a big chunk of Tencent, a Chinese company. Also doing well today were ArcelorMittal, which was up by 8.5%, and Anglo American up by 5.5%. Well, we close off with the first South African original movie to have been funded and produced by the mighty Amazon. It could be opening a whole new door in this industry in South Africa. And let's have a listen in with the director, a man with a typically South African name, Ari Kruger.
Yeah, so it's a crime comedy. It's about a very well-respected medical aid / insurance broker who lives in Cape Town, and he has got himself into hot water because he's having an affair with his physiotherapist. And when he breaks up with her and she gets upset and decides to extort him, he decides to go to his brother, who is his black sheep brother, who's in the underworld, to help him make the problem go away. And then things just kind of spiral out of control from there. And the next thing, this very kind of well-to-do guy has a whole criminal underworld after him. Yeah, and it's a crime caper, and it's fun. It's got comedy, and it's also got a lot of heart.
Well, the characters are quite interesting. You've got this Jewish family, and you've got these two criminals that are really, really funny. You know, tell us a little bit more about them.
Well, I am quite inspired generally just by characters in South Africa, as well as characters that you kind of find in the underworld of South Africa as well. So I just drew a lot of inspiration from real life, and you know, people around me, people that are kind of seen out there in the public sphere.
So you know, how did it come about that Amazon Prime Video has commissioned this?
They hadn't even fully set up shop here, but they really had decided, you know, let's get this one out the gate first. And we were just fortunate to have gotten this film commissioned quite early on in the process.
Does this mean the big streamers have found the South African filmmaking scene?
You would hope so, but you would hope so. I mean, Netflix is also here, and they are commissioning work, and you know, and putting out a lot of South African titles, and have had success with some of the titles that they've put out. Amazon, as I'm sure you would have heard, have since retracted from the market for the time being. I still am optimistic that they will come back. But there was a global restructure there, as far as I know. I don't know too much about the reasons behind it.
Yeah, do you think we have a unique brand of humor that we can sell?
I do think so. I think that South African humor comes through very much in the characters. We're obviously a very diverse nation, and with that comes a huge diversity, a range of diverse characters.
I think we're good at laughing at ourselves. And I think when it comes to slang and vernacular, we've got very hyper-local ways of expressing ourselves. And you know, it's funny in some ways. And I think that South Africans love to see that reflected on screen. But then I think internationally as well, people are leaning in and saying, like, well, what does lekker mean? And, you know, why is he calling him brew? And it's these kind of hyper-local things which, yeah, I just feel are our currency. And then I think we've also advanced and matured from the Leon Schuster days of being extremely slapstick. I do think that there has been an evolution of South African comedy. We certainly feel that in the commercials that South Africa makes. Like, I think that there's a maturity now to the humor, and I feel like we really can compete on a global stage as far as comedy is concerned.
That's Ari Kruger, the director of the movie Shakedown. Watch out for that on Amazon Prime. And he was talking to my colleague, Linda van Tilburg. Well, that's our show for the week. Indeed, we have the BizNews briefing from Monday to Thursday. You can pick up the audio around 5 o'clock on BizNews Radio and the full visual TV version on YouTube from 6. Until next week. Have a wonderful break. It's Alec Hogg from BizNews. Cheerio.